in terms of supplies and medications.
Finally, Dr. Hamam Alo, your message at this point to the United States, where we're based, and to the world?
Actually, the message hasn't changed since the beginning of this war. First, we need this war to end because we are really humans. We are no animals. We have the right to live freely. Second, if you want your citizens to live under these circumstances, what would you do for them? This is what we exactly would like you to do for us as a superpower country, as the United States, because you are really as human as your U.S. citizens are. We were expecting more earlier, I mean, solutions for that humanitarian and healthcare catastrophes and the crises. But what we are seeing mainly through trucks allowed into Gaza is nothing compared to us. So we are being exterminated. We are being massively eradicated. And you pretend to care for humanitarian and human rights, which is not what we are living now. To prove us wrong, please do something. Thank you.
Dr. Hamam Alo, speaking to us from Gaza City, where he works at the largest hospital, Al-Shifa Hospital. Please be safe.
I hope I will be. Let's hope both together I will be. Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up, we speak to the Israeli historian Ilan Pape, author of many books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Stay with us.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free. And all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
Be Free by the Lebanese-Swedish singer Marzane, who sung at an Istanbul solidarity protest on Saturday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Internal Israeli government documents have revealed the Israeli Ministry of Intelligence is recommending the forcible transfer of the entire population of Gaza to the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. The 10-page document, which is dated October 13th, has been published in full by the Israeli news outlets Local Call and Plus 972. The document recommends transferring all Palestinians to Egypt and setting up a, quote, sterile zone of several kilometers near the border between Egypt and Gaza. In addition, the document recommends Israel then prevent the, quote, return of the population to activities residences near the border with Israel, unquote. Fears of a new Nakba, or catastrophe, have been growing ever since Israel ordered all Palestinians living in Gaza City and in North Gaza to vacate their homes and head south. On Monday, Palestinian UN Ambassador Riyad Mansour accused Israel of trying to depopulate Gaza.
They want to depopulate the Gaza Strip completely from the entire population and throw them in the lap of Egypt in the Sinai Desert. No one should justify our killing or find reasons to give more time to the killer. Call for an end of this assault on an entire nation. stop the killings in the West Bank by settlers and occupation forces and the forced displacement underway there.
We go now to Haifa in Israel, where we're joined by the Israeli historian Ilan Pape. He's professor of history and the director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. He's the author of several books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, as well as The Idea of Israel, A History of Power and Knowledge. 50 years ago, Ilan Pape fought in the Israeli military during the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, has since become a leading critic of Israel's occupation. Professor Pape, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can start off by talking about your take on what's happening today. You just heard the doctor in Gaza who just left Al-Shifa a few minutes ago.
Yes, I think, Amy, it's good to be back on your program. Thank you for having me. I think what we are seeing now, what unfolds in front of our eyes, is a genocidal situation. By which people are targeted, whether they are children, babies, in hospital or in schools. And this is a massive operation of killing, of ethnic cleansing, of depopulation. The pretext for that kind of savagery is revenge for what the Hamas did on the 7th of October. But I think the real intention here is not just revenge, but trying to exploit what happened on the 7th of October to create new realities, an historical Palestine. You called it a new Nakba. I think that this is the Nakba has never really ended for the Palestinians. So it's a new horrific chapter in the ongoing Nakba that the Palestinians are suffering here. So this is really a horrific situation that can only be stopped from the outside, because there is no motivation inside Israel to stop the operations, nor to care more about the lives of innocent people, despite what the Israeli army claims to do in the field itself.
I want to play a short clip of Prime Minister Netanyahu speaking over the weekend.
You must remember what Amalek has done to you, says our Holy Bible. And we do remember, and we are fighting our brave troops and combatants who are now in Gaza or around Gaza and in all other regions in Israel are joining this chain of Jewish heroes, a chain that has started 3,000 years ago from Joshua ben Nun until the heroes of 1948, the Six-Day War, the 73 October War, and all other wars in this country. Our hero troops, they have one supreme main goal: to completely defeat the murderous enemy and to guarantee our existence in this country. We've always said, never again. Never again is now.
And I want to play Netanyahu from last night.
Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas, to surrender to terrorism, to surrender to barbarism. That will not happen.
Can you respond to the Israeli Prime Minister, Professor Pape?
Yes. I think the main attempt here is to make sure that people do not understand the context in which the Hamas operation occurred. To totally dishistoricize that event, to forget about the 15 years of the inhuman siege on Gaza, or 56 years of a ruthless occupation and ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, and 75 years of not allowing refugees to come back to their homes. I think this is an attempt to Nazify the Palestinians, which is not new, by the way. The Israelis every now and then use it. If you remember, Menachem Begin compared Yasser Arafat in the bunker in 1982 to Hitler in the bunker. The Nazification of the Palestinians is meant to, first of all, license Israeli policies without any consideration to international law or human rights, and secondly, to divert us from talking about the real issue here, which is not the Hamas or its actions on the 7th of October, but rather the situation that bred this kind of violence. Rather than talking about the symptom of violence, we should talk about the source of violence. And the source of violence has not changed. We have millions of Palestinians for years being oppressed, ruled and controlled by Israel. And they are fighting with the means that they have. And this is going to go on unless, of course, there is a willingness to go back to the negotiation table and ask why the violence erupted in the first place and what are the best ways to prevent another cycle of violence in the future. There's a second reason for Netanyahu's rhetoric. Of course, he doesn't want the Israeli media or the international community to deal with his own problems that were very acute before the 7th of October, and to say this is now a situation where you cannot at all, but this is a domestic issue, you cannot talk about me or my failures. This is a moment of existential threat to Israel, and therefore this kind of rhetoric will continue. And it's very dangerous, not to mention the fact that it abuses, when they use the Holocaust, it abuses the Holocaust memory, because with all the horror of what happened on the 7th of October, this is not the Holocaust, and there's no comparison between Palestinians who act after years of oppression and siege to Nazis who just target Jews because of their Jews. There's no comparison. This whole language is not the one to be used. And I think that Netanyahu is trying to galvanize a very vindictive Israel behind him. And the results of this kind of policy are unfolding in front of our eyes. And we just had this horrific and very moving kind of report that you had with a doctor from Gaza before me.
Professor Pape, can you talk about the hostage families? They don't get a lot of attention what they're calling for, though they get tremendous attention for who these hostages are and the people who were killed on October 7th. But there are many. For example, we interviewed Noy Katzman, the brother of Chaim, who was killed by Hamas on October 7th. He said his brother was a peace activist, and he himself said, not in my brother's name. He's called for a ceasefire. And I wanted to ask you about this force of the hostage families and about the everybody for everybody proposal. On Friday, just after we got off the broadcast, it said, you know, imminent major release. And some thought that Netanyahu was pushing forward with the invasion more quickly because he didn't want this possibility to happen. But explain the proposal of all hostages, over 200 of them, in return for all Palestinian prisoners, and who these prisoners are, close to 7,000 of them.
Yes, I think that not everybody among the families, because I don't think they're all made of the same cloth, but many of them understand that the only way to bring their dear ones back home is this kind of an exchange of prisoners. We are talking about thousands of Palestinians who are incarcerated in Israeli jails, many of them without trials. And they are, their kind of, the allegations against them vary from actual participation in guerrilla or violent actions against Israeli citizens or soldiers, and those who are incarcerated for being a member of a Palestinian organization. They are, some of them are very young, some of them are women, some of them are very old and have been there for a very long time, and some of them were just recently incarcerated without trial in the West Bank. They are all part of the Palestinian Liberation Movement, and it needs a very different Israeli perception of the Palestinian struggle and those who participated in its struggle to be able to say, indeed, this is the only way forward, namely to release all of them to the last one and receive all of the people who were taken by the Hamas on the 7th of October. What I can tell you, Amy, which is very interesting, that former generals in the Israeli army, former heads of the Israeli Mossad and Shabak, the secret service, are supporting this kind of exchange. And this is a very important position that they are holding, and that may explain the fear on Netanyahu's side to let this issue extend longer, because the voices that are calling for such an exchange are not coming from the extreme Israeli left or the liberal Zionists. They're coming from some very powerful people who were heading some of Israel's most important institutions, such as the Mossad, the army, and the secret service. Will it take place? I don't know. It depends very much on how things unfold on the ground itself with the invasion, that nobody in Israel gives the Israeli public any details of how it goes on. But it seems that it doesn't go as well as the Israelis claim it does. And depends a lot, of course, of the international community, because quite a few of the people who are held by the Hamas have also dual citizenship. But there's no doubt, Amy, this is the only way to release the people who were taken on Saturday. Neither Israeli commando salvage operation nor piecemeal deal will bring all the people back. This is a situation where you can solve the problem and not delay it for another 5 or 6 years with babies and old people who might not survive a long stay in captivity.
Professor Pape, you were born to German Jewish parents who fled German persecution, the Nazis, in the 1930s. You fought in 1973 in the Israeli military. Can you talk about your life trajectory and how you came to write a book talking about the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the response in Israeli society, your university, University of Haifa, and how you ended up at Exeter?
Yes, it was, Amy, it was a journey. There was no one moment of epiphany or awakening that makes you actually take positions which will frame you as a traitor in your own society and definitely would leave you with no reference group in your own society. And for me, it was a journey that had many important stations, such as spending some time as a postgraduate student outside of Israel, having an Arab supervisor, looking as an historian who was interested in the history of my own country, in the documentation that became available about 1948. So all these possibilities outside to meet Palestinians on equal footing, to be able to research as a professional historian's history or documentation that revealed evidence that contradicted in a very significant way the narrative in which I grew upon. All this led me to a moment where I thought that I understand what is going on in historical Palestine, what went on in historical Palestine, and I saw quite clearly, at least from my perspective, who were the victimizers, who were the victim, who was the colonizer, who was the colonized, who was the ethnic cleanser, and who was the victims of ethnic cleanse. And because my parents came from Germany, and because we lost a lot of people in the Holocaust, exactly because of that legacy, I felt I could not be indifferent to the suffering of the Palestinians, nor did I want to be part of the society that caused these suffering. And I think that as the years go by and the research becomes more and more intensive, and my understanding and relationship with the Palestinians become more increased and widened, I'm even more confident today than I was in the early years of my career, either as an activist or as a professional historian, that I'm very at peace with my moral positions toward Israel and Zionism. In 2006, that position led to pressure from my university to leave the university and to resign. So I had no choice. I had to resign and I had to leave. I was very lucky to be offered a position in a university in Britain where I founded the Center for Palestine Studies. I'm still a citizen of Israel. I'm still going to Israel. I'm spending time in Israel. I'm spending time in Britain. I'm trying to divide between the two places. And I still believe that what I cherish as human rights, as human morality, is the only basis for better life for everyone concerned, Jews and Palestinians alike, in a state in the future that would be based on equality, that would not discriminate against people because of their nationality, religion, or culture, and one which will rectify past evils and would allow refugees to return and hopefully build a state that would radiate and influence the Middle East as a whole.
Ilan Pappe, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of history, director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter, author of many books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and Gaza in Crisis, which he co-wrote with Noam Chomsky. Coming up, United Auto Workers has ended its historic six-week strike against the big three automakers. Stay with us.
Marching down Sackville Street with a starry plow on high. Here comes the citizens' army with its first race through the sky. Leading them is a mighty man with a mad rage in his eye. My name it is James Connolly and I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class, the small farmer too, to protect the proletariat from the bosses and the screws. Hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the dream of a republic for the working class.
James Connolly by Black 47, featuring Gary Ogg. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major victory, the United Auto Workers announced Monday they reached a tentative agreement with General Motors following deals with Ford and Stellantis last week. This brings an end to the UAW's historic 46-day-long strike against the Detroit Big Three automakers. UAW President Sean Fain addressed members on Monday.
We have won record agreements at Ford, Stellantis, and now GM. We have united our membership like never before. We have shown the companies, the American public, and the whole world that the working class is not done fighting. In fact, we're just getting started.
On Monday, Democracy Now! Spoke to Scott Hudson, a member of UAW Local 551, works at Ford Chicago Assembly Plant, is on the steering committee chair of Unite All Workers for Democracy, the union's reform caucus.
Our plant was part of the third round of stand-up strikes, and the strategy was to kind of play one company off the other, looking for better terms. It is a new strategy. In the past, they've targeted one company and negotiated with them while the others were on hold. But the stand-up strike also had an inside strategy where workers that were still on the job at different plants were instructed to refuse voluntary overtime and try to work to the letter of the contract so that they would kind of slow things down for the company at the plants that were running. So there was an inside-outside strategy to that.
So that's Scott Hudson. For more, we're joined in Detroit by Jane Slaughter, founder of Labor Notes, where she's covered the auto industry since 1979. Before that, she was briefly an auto worker. She's the author of many books, including Secrets of a Successful Organizer. Her recent piece in Jacobin is headlined, "We Can Thank a Union Reform Caucus for the Militant UAW Strike." So, Jane, welcome to Democracy Now! Tell us what you understand these deals entail.
They entail a whole lot of money. They will be life-changing for some of the lowest-paid members of the union, the so-called temps, who actually work for years although being called temps. These people who are now making $17, $18, $19 an hour, within 4 years, they'll be making over $40 an hour. So the union made a huge effort to bring its lower paid members up and to get rid of the nefarious tiers that have been dividing the workforce in auto since 2007, 2009.
And how did they accomplish this?
By striking and by organizing the members. The new administration has really only fully been in power since late March, but they immediately set out to try to get members involved in a way they've never been before, in letting the companies know that they were willing to strike and ready to fight to bring their wages up and undo some of the other injustices that had happened over the years. So they got members doing things they called practice picketing. They'd have demonstrations outside the plants. They had everybody wearing red shirts in the plant as just a signal to management that we're all unified here. It was really unprecedented in this union that the members would be organized to let their feelings be known to the companies.
And if you can talk about, Jane, who Sean Fain is, you know, the headline of your piece, we can thank a union reform caucus for the militant UAW strike. Explain how this new leadership came into power.
Yes, none of this would have been happening if it were the old UAW. Top UAW leaders were caught in very egregious corruption. 13 of them went to jail, including two presidents for embezzlement and other crimes, dealing with the companies in an unprincipled way. And the government stepped in and gave the members the opportunity to decide that they wanted to be able to choose their top leaders rather than them being chosen, as in the old system, just at a convention that was very tightly controlled. So once the members had the right to vote on their top officers, they voted in this new slate. Now, this slate was called UAWD, Unite All Workers for Democracy. It was formed in 2019 expressly with the purpose of trying to get the right to vote. They won. They ran seven candidates for the executive board. They were all elected. And once they had a majority on the executive board, things could start changing from the top, encouraging the members also to change things from the bottom.
And can you talk about the strategy used, the stand-up strikes?
Yes, this was a way to keep the companies off balance, and boy, did it work. To me, it seemed like management just had no idea how to respond to this new strategy. They were used to a very ceremonial, ritualistic process of bargaining. It was the same every time. This time, Sean Fain, the president, said, we are going to not let you know what we're going to be doing next. And so they would call strikes at who knew which plant it was going to be, three plants just to start with, and they added in a bunch of smaller facilities. Then each week, new plants would be added. And if a company was cooperating and actually giving in some things at the bargaining table, then they might not get struck that week. But if they were being recalcitrant, then they would get struck. And then towards the end, the union pulled out its really big guns and struck the most profitable plants. And that's when the companies caved.
And what does the vote, when does that take place? In fact, people are going back to work.
They're going back to work. The vote will take place sometime over the next two, maybe 3 weeks.
And what about places like Tesla that are non-union?
Huh. Well, it was just announced that there exists, has already been in existence, an organizing committee at Tesla. The union very much, of course, wants to organize Tesla, but also all the other many, many, many non-union auto plants that exist now, as you know. Toyota, Mercedes, BMW, Nissan, many others have set up, mostly in the South. All those plants are non-union. And now, in my view, there's going to be a tremendous incentive for those workers to join the union once they see what's in the
contract. Jane Slaughter, we're going to have to leave it there. Founder of Labor Notes, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Isn't it awesome to turn on the radio and hear your friends on your favorite shows? Keep the party here at CJSF going. Support your most favorite people on the airwaves and make a donation to Fundrive at cjsf.ca/donate.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.